Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the October 12th edition of Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and I welcome you to our latest podcast. We are recording this week from the guest room of the Admiral Benbow Inn, where we have been made most welcome. And I want to start out this week, and we have a lot to cover. I want to start out this week reading some mail. As you know, I begin, I end every podcast inviting you to write to our producer of that week if you have any complaints. And of course, no one ever does. But also to write to me if you have anything nice to say. And I'm happy to say that this week I received two letters, or I chose these two out of the hundreds that we received, that our own mailman, one Gary F. Taylor, who staggers in here every week with the load of mail that he receives. This was about our beer podcast that we did last week. My friend Chuck Mobley joined me, and we talked about fall beers and the history of seasonal beer. And here's a letter. Dr. Deaton, a man after my own heart, beer. My wife and I had a great time listening to you and your guest chat about beer last week. I'm a big fan of stouts myself. My wife always says, it's like drinking a meal. Why don't you just drink your dinner? And to that, I always respond, if you insist, dear. What a fun topic. We enjoyed this and all of your podcasts. Keep them coming. Your fan, Louie Riley of Bainbridge, Georgia. Louie, thank you so much for that letter. And we didn't really talk a whole lot about stouts last week, but stouts are one of my favorites. I usually wait until winter to have a stout. It is a beer you can almost cut with a knife. Many of the Christmas stouts taste like gingerbread cookies. So I highly recommend a stout. Louie Riley, Bainbridge, Georgia, enjoying the podcast and the beer. This next letter doubles as both fan mail and a nomination for Worst Invention Known to Man, which we will do this week. Hey, Stan, I'll tell you the worst invention known to man, near beer. What crazy cook thought of that? Your pal Saul Pearson, P.S., if I ever make it down yonder to Savannah, I'll buy you a beer. The real kind, not near beer. Thank you, Saul. You're absolutely right. That is obviously one of the worst inventions known to man, and we did not talk about seasonal near beer. I'm not even aware that there is any, but I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast and the beer. As always, if you would like to send me a note, please do so at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. Georgia history all spelled out. We move now into notable passings, and since we didn't do this last week, I'm going to cover a couple of weeks. These are people who died that you may or may not have heard about. It's my job to keep you up to date. You may have heard that Monty Hall died. If you grew up in the 70s as I did, you saw him every afternoon on the great show Let's Make a Deal. Monty Hall was Canadian. Fun fact known by few. He died on September 30th at the age of 96. That show has come back on the air with a new host. And you win this week's No Prize if you can tell me. Send me a note and tell me who's hosting the latest incarnation of Let's Make a Deal. Of course, everyone heard about Tom Petty's death, the great rock and roller who was from Gainesville, Florida. They were very proud of that. Often came up while I was a student at the University of Florida there. He died on Monday, October 2nd at the age of 66. And I only talk about him because in all the obituaries of Tom Petty, I did not see anything about his work doing voiceover on King of the Hill. He did the voice for the recurring character Lucky. He did that in seasons 8 through 12, a total of about 21 episodes. You may remember that Lucky was kind of a redneck white trash character who did not work. He, as he put it, he slipped on pee-pee at the Megalomart, and he received a check in the mail every month, and he didn't work. He was really funny. Tom Petty did a great job with that. Tom Petty died October 2nd at the age of 66. A history death that you probably didn't hear about. If you watched the great series Band of Brothers when it came on several years ago, you may remember Donald Malarkey, who was played by Scott Grimes. Donald Malarkey was a World War II paratrooper who was awarded the Bronze Star after he parachuted behind the lines at Normandy. He died at the age of 96 on September 30th in Salem, Oregon. Again, one of the members of Easy Company, and with what limited research I did, it appears that there are only about a dozen members of Easy Company that are still alive. Donald Malarkey, a World War II veteran and hero, died at the age of 96. One of the letters we got a couple of weeks ago was from my friend Jim Ogden, who is historian at the Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Military Park and the Moccasin Bend National Archaeological District. And Jim reminded me, or told me about, the death of a noted historian that I didn't know about, Dr. Duane King, who was the former executive director of the Gilcrease Museum, and he's widely recognized as an authority on American Indian culture and history. He was the founding editor of the Journal of Cherokee Studies. He got his undergraduate at the University of Tennessee and his master's and PhD from the University of Georgia. And Dr. King died on September 17th at the age of 70. So we note his passing here. Again, my thanks to my friend Jim Ogden for letting me know about that.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River.
And since this is obviously a podcast about history, 20 years ago today, on October 12th, 1997, John Denver died, killed when his small aircraft crashed into Monterey Bay, California. He was 53 years old. I grew up listening to the music of John Denver in the 1970s, and after his death 20 years ago, I kind of rediscovered it. He was always known as the poet of the Rocky Mountains. His music, easily caricatured maybe in the 1970s, his whole image with being sort of the nature boy. But rediscovering him 20 years later, I realized how special his music was, how very different it was from everything else. Any song is still one of the most beautiful songs I think I've ever heard. Rocky Mountain High became one of Colorado's official state songs 10 years after his death in March of 2007. And you may notice this year that his music appears in a whole spate of movies and TV shows. And that's because his three children, who survive, who are now grown, have hired a new management team to manage his estate. And so you will probably hear, and they've done a really good job of getting his music back out there for a whole new generation to hear. On December 1st, the Windstar Greatest Hits of John Denver will be released, and I will be getting a copy of that. And if his music finds a whole new audience in the 21st century, I think that would be a wonderful thing. Just a short, quick story about the song you were listening to, Take Me Home Country Roads. John Denver co-wrote that with Taffy Nivert and Bill Danoff, who became husband and wife and who formed a group called Fat City. They sang the backup vocals on that song that you heard, and they co-wrote that song. In fact, they were writing it for, hoped to send it to, and have it recorded by Johnny Cash. But John Denver was friends of theirs. He went over to their apartment one night after playing in Washington, D.C. He listened to them play that song, and he actually wrote the bridge for that song, and it became his standard bearer that he played for the rest of his life on stage. John Denver died 20 years ago on October 12th, 1997. And finally, to end with the passings this week, this is not a notable passing. This is one very personal to me. My friend Scott Broadwell died 40 years ago last week, or 2 weeks ago, on September 25th, 1977. Scott was 15 years old. It was a great personal loss to me, and I still remember Scott warmly. I have his baseball card collection. I have complete sets of 1973 and 74 Topps baseball cards that belong to Scott. His parents, Bobby and Jean, gave me many things that belonged to Scott after his death, including his Pittsburgh Steelers jacket. I think that's one reason I became a Steelers fan. I got some of his books, but I remember Scott well. His father, Bobby, is still alive. Bobby still remembers Scott every day and think about him. A great friend, a special guy. Scott Broadwell died 40 years ago, September 25th, 1977. We're going to move now into this week in history and take a look at the time capsule of things that happened in time that you may remember. 35 years ago, on September 29th, 1982, extra-strength Tylenol capsules laced with cyanide killed the first of seven people in Chicago, and to date the case remains unsolved. I remember this very well because on that date in 1982, I had been a student at the University of Georgia for all of 12 days. I had a lot of headaches under the stress of being in a new environment and in college classrooms, and I was popping extra strength Tylenol like candy. My mother called me on the black wall phone we had in our dorm at Millage Hall and told me about this. And I nearly freaked out. And, of course, everybody did at that time. Everybody freaked out because nobody knew how widespread this was or where it was going to end. But that happened 35 years ago. And as I mentioned to date, the case remains unsolved. 60 years ago, September 25th, 1957, nine black students at Little Rock High School in Arkansas who had been forced to withdraw because of racist backlash and demonstrations were escorted to class on that day, 60 years ago, by members of the 101st Airborne Division integrating Little Rock High School and setting off a year like no one there had ever seen, a big moment in American history and in the civil rights movement. 90 years ago, yesterday, on October 11th, 1927, marked Lindbergh Day in Atlanta. Of course, Charles Lindbergh had made the first historic flight across the Atlantic in 1927, and on October 11th, he arrived in Atlanta for Lindbergh Day. He came to Atlanta thanks to city alderman and aviation enthusiast William Hartsfield, who, of course, Hartsfield Airport was named for. He landed the Spirit of St. Louis at Candler Field in Hapeville, which became the Atlanta Airport. He was given an official welcome by Georgia Governor Lamartine Hardeman and the Atlanta Mayor Isaac Ragsdale, and there was a huge parade through downtown Atlanta all the way to Georgia Tech Stadium. In fact, this was marked as the largest public gathering in Atlanta until the premiere of Gone with the Wind in 1939. Lindbergh talked about the potential of commercial flight, and as you know, Atlanta took note that day. His visit led directly to the improvements at Candler Field, upgrades that eventually brought airmail and Delta and Eastern Airlines to the city. Candler Field eventually became Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, one of the busiest airports in the world, and it all started 90 years ago yesterday with Lindbergh Day, October 11th, 1927. And finally, I want to mention somebody who was born 100 years ago that you probably never heard of, but that you should get to know his work. Clinton Rossiter was a political scientist and American historian. He was born 100 years ago, September 18th, 1917, in Philadelphia. He is one of the best historians who has ever written. Most people don't know his work anymore. You may occasionally in a used bookstore come across a book he wrote called Seed Time of the Republic. It won the Bancroft Prize and the Woodrow Wilson Foundation Award about the political origins of our country. One of the best books ever written about the Constitutional Convention was his book 1787, The Grand Convention. I read it a couple of years ago. It is absolutely, without a doubt, the best book on the Constitutional Convention that I've ever written. He wrote other books that you may see from time to time, or that you should certainly seek out if you don't know about it. The American Presidency. Just a really prolific historian who tragically died at the age of 52 in 1970. His son, Caleb Rossiter, is currently a professor at American University in Washington, D.C. He's written a very moving account of his father's life and death that you can read online. I commend all of his books to you and think you should look them up. Look for them in used bookstores. You can still order them on Amazon. Clinton Rossiter, born 100 years ago, September 18th, 1917. We turn now to history in the news, and we talked about the Ken Burns series, The Vietnam War, here a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. And I came across a review of the series written by novelist Amy Phan, P-H-A-N, that was written in the October 3rd edition of the San Francisco Chronicle, critical of the series. And I think that you would profit from reading that. Amy Phan, of course, is the author of two books of fiction, teaches writing and literature at California College of the Arts in Oakland and San Francisco. Worth reading her review, critical as it is. In fact, it's titled, Ken Burns' The Vietnam War Offers Same Narrative with Little New Perspective. Check that out. My friend Colin Gwinnett Sharp is directly descended from Button Gwinnett, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And I had the good pleasure to meet this gentleman several years ago. He stopped by the Georgia Historical Society. He is descended from Button Gwinnett, he's not a direct descendant of Gwinnett himself, but a collateral descendant. And he got interested in Button Gwinnett, and he lives in England, he's retired now, and a couple of weeks ago he sent me a booklet that was put out. They have restored the graves of Button Gwinnett's mother and father at Down Hatherley. Down Hatherley is in Gloucestershire in southwest England, and Button Gwinnett's parents, and you probably know who Button Gwinnett is, obviously. Button Gwinnett has probably the most sought-after signature in American history. He was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence from Georgia who was killed in a duel in 1777. His signature became very valuable, in part because he simply did not live very long. He didn't sign that many documents. And so when the signers' sets began to be put together in the 19th century by autograph seekers, they found out, quite by accident, that Button Gwinnett's was the rarest of all, and thus one of the most valuable. Button Gwinnett's father, Samuel, was rector at Down Hatherley at the church there from 1727 until his death in 1775. at the age of 75. And his wife, Anne, is also buried in the churchyard. She died in 1768 at the age of 74. Their son, Button, was living in America at that time. And they recently restored these graves. They had sort of forgotten even where they were. But some really good detective work turned them up. They raised enough funds to restore the grave in 2016. So this piece of history in England that is tied directly to one of the founding fathers of the American Republic has been recently restored by the good folks at Down Hatherley in England. And if you're interested at all in Button Gwinnett, I commend Colin's book to you. It's called Button Gwinnett, Failed Merchant, Plantation Owner, Mountebank, Opportunist Politician, and Founding Father. You can find it on Amazon. Again, Button Gwinnett's parents' graves restored in Down Hatherley, England. Those of you lucky enough to see the Alexander Hamilton musical, you may have also read the great biography by Ron Chernow. If you have, you'll be interested to know that the Library of Congress has put the papers of Alexander Hamilton online for the first time in their original format. The library holds the largest collection of Hamilton papers, approximately 12,000 items that go from 1777, when Hamilton was about 22 years old, until his death in 1804. Everything you can imagine, letters, legal papers, drafts of speeches and writings. And in fact, they recently acquired 55 items that had been privately held previously, mostly letters from Hamilton's father-in-law, General Philip Schuyler, who of course was one of Washington's lieutenants during the war, that had been digitized and made available for the first time. Now, interesting, Congress bought the papers of Alexander Hamilton in 1848, $20,000. They bought these from his widow, Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton. Again, her father was General Philip Schuyler. Hamilton died very young, before his 50th birthday in 1804. But Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton, his widow, most people don't know this, she lived to the ripe old age of 97. She outlived him by 50 years. She died November 9th, 1854. It was by her good graces that the Library of Congress was able to purchase the Hamilton papers originally. And these papers are among the collections newly available online during the past year from the Library of Congress. Others include the papers of U.S. Presidents Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and William Henry Harrison, but also the papers of Sigmund Freud. Did you know the Library of Congress held those? I did not. Again, that speaks more to my ignorance than anything else. A collection of more than 4,600 newspapers from Japanese-American internment camps, a collection of web-based comics, books, and 25,000 fire insurance maps from communities across America. That's the first installment of 500,000 that will be available and accessible online. So again, go to loc.gov, check out the papers of Alexander Hamilton. And finally, if you're a fan of Sherman's March to the Sea, and let's face it, who isn't? There is a great new article by Mark Grimsley in the fall issue of the Civil War Monitor, and it's called The March to the Sea Part 1, and it seeks to understand why the Georgia part of Sherman's campaign, which also, of course, went through the Carolinas, still makes people so mad today. And boy, does it ever. The Georgia Historical Society put up a couple of markers a few years ago about the March to the Sea. And we caught holy hell from some of the stuff that we put on that marker. Again, after 150 years, based on solid scholarship published over the last 50 years, a lot of people just didn't like the fact that we didn't say that Sherman burned everything to the ground between Atlanta and Savannah, because the fact is, he did not. Mark Grimsley talked about some of this in an article called The March to the Sea Part 1. I commend it to you. It's in the fall 2017 edition of the Civil War Monitor. And finally this week, books that landed on my desk. There were two books that I found very interesting that I want to bring to your attention this week. The first is published by the University of Georgia Press, and it is Hamilton Jerdon's memoir. It's called A Boy from Georgia, Coming of Age in the Segregated South. Excuse me. When Hamilton Jerdon died of peritoneal mesothelioma in 2008, you may remember, he left behind a mostly finished memoir, and it has been completed by his daughter, Kathleen. And the University of Georgia Press has published it. It is a great coming-of-age story by one of our great political strategists. Of course, he managed Jimmy Carter's successful presidential campaign of 1976. I commend UGA Press Director Lisa Bayer and her staff for bringing this book out. You'll want to look at it. A Boy from Georgia, Coming of Age in the Segregated South, written by Hamilton Jerdon, edited by his daughter Kathleen Jerdon, and the foreword is by President Jimmy Carter. It's available now and out from the University of Georgia Press. The second book I want to tell you about is written by a friend of mine, and her name is Karen Cox. She is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. But friend of mine or no, she has written a terrific new book that you will be hearing about. This is going to probably be an award winner if you haven't heard about it already. And it has a great title. It's called Goat Castle. Yes, Goat, G-O-A-T. Goat Castle, A True Story of Murder, Race, and the Gothic South. And Karen unearthed a great story, has brought it to light. And I'll just tell you about it very briefly. This just comes from the book jacket itself. In 1932, the city of Natchez, Mississippi, had an unexpected influx of journalists and tourists as the lurid story of a local murder made nationwide headlines. Two eccentric people, Richard Dana and Octavia Dockery, known in the press as the Wild Man and the Goat Woman, enlisted an African-American man named George Pearls to rob their reclusive neighbor, Jenny Merrill, of her estate, or at her estate. And during the attempted robbery, Merrill was shot and killed. The crime drew national attention. It came to light that Dana and Dockery, the alleged murderers, shared their huge, decaying antebellum mansion with their goats and other livestock, which prompted journalists to call the estate Goat Castle. The African-American man, Pearls, was killed by an Arkansas policeman in an unrelated incident before he could face trial, but as was all too typical in the Jim Crow South, the white community demanded justice, and an innocent black woman named Emily Burns was ultimately sent to prison for the murder. And Dana and Dockery, the two white folk, not only avoided punishment, but also lived to profit from the notoriety of their murder. And Karen Cox tells this entire fascinating story, visits the scene, talks to people who were related, who knew about this. It is a fascinating story. This book has been published by the University of North Carolina Press, and on the front cover she has a blurb from the one and only John Grisham, who says this is a highly entertaining story about a long-forgotten murder. It is also a reminder of the racism and intolerance found in Southern history and of how difficult change has been. It's a terrific read, unquote, and I agree with him. You will want to check out this book. Again, it's called Goat Castle, A True Story of Murder, Race, and the Gothic South. 240 pages. It's available from the University of North Carolina Press. Written by my friend Karen Cox, who is a great Southern historian. You can check out Karen at her website, KarenLCoxAuthor.com. Or if you're going to be in Nashville, Tennessee this weekend, you can see her at the Southern Festival of Books, Sunday, October 15th, 3 o'clock. She'll be there. For those of you in Georgia, Wednesday, November 1st, 2017, she's going to be at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library in Atlanta at 7 p.m. that night, signing copies and talking about her book, Goat Castle, A True Story of Murder, Race, and the Gothic South, out from the University of North Carolina Press. This is one that people are going to be talking about. We covered a lot of ground this week, and I thank you for staying with me. If you did, long-suffering listeners, as I said, we recorded this week from the corner table of the guest room at the Admiral Benbow Inn. Our producer this week has been Jim Hawkins. And as always, if you have any complaints or bad things that you want to say about this podcast, please send those to Jim. Anything nice you want to say, any compliments or just general good thoughts about history or life in general, please send those to me at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. Our mailman this week and every week, staggering under the load of all the mail we receive here, is one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised. That's right. Our caterer this week is my friend Brett Hagee, who runs Hagee's House of Pancakes. They won't kill you. They're pretty good. Our legal counsel this week is the Law Office of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, if you come to us, you better look good in orange. The hardest working engineer in show business this week and every week is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. You can find out everything that's going on at the Georgia Historical Society at our website, georgiahistory.com. You can check out my blog and other similarly painful podcasts as this one at Off the Deaton Path, found at deatonpath.georgiahistory.com. That wraps it up this week. Please join us again next week. So long, everybody.